Sandra, and Noah.
Well, hey.
Hello, this is the Theater World Podcast. Yes. My name's Noah Bender.
And I'm Sandra Nemchek. Here we are.
And we're talking to the movers and shakers in the world of theater. But first, let's talk about some recent theater, some theater that we've seen. Like, we're theater commentators. We can talk about our own experiences as well.
Yeah. I mean, we've been all over. You have LA theater connections. I have like the Bay Area theater connections right now.
I have been plugged in lately at the Center Theater Group in Los Angeles. Their season this season has been nothing short of spectacular. Recently, this past week, I saw the revival of 1776 at the Amundsen.
Oh, wow. So 1776, when they redid it on Broadway, they had like an all-female cast. Was this an all-female cast?
Yes. It was most of the same cast from Broadway. This revival from last year, if you didn't know, which was, instead of, old middle-aged white men, like the show is kind of written for, this show played it with female, trans, non-binary, femme, diverse, people of color, like just anybody but white men on stage.
The people that really represent America, actually.
Yeah, like I think the statement they were kind of making towards the end, which kind of came through all at once in the second act, was that, the musical is all about the signing of the Declaration of Independence and like kind of how we interact with the American myth of the founding fathers and whatnot. And they're kind of saying, this document was drafted by flawed, rich men that obviously don't represent the whole country. And now that we are kind of stepping into their shoes and telling this story from their perspective as who we are, who this diverse cast, kind of emblematic of how, the power dynamics in America are shifting and, they are taking the political power back. But overall, I don't know. What do you think about 1776? It's just not really the show for me.
Yeah, I remember watching the movie as maybe like middle schooler and just kind of being like, this is a snooze fest. Like Mr. Feeny was in it from Boy Meets World. And I was just like, the songs are not that catchy. There's like one where they're like singing about opening up a window because it's too hot in there. Yes. And they want to draft like the Declaration of Independence or something like that. Or is the Constitution one of those things that they were drafting?
I mean, it's a stuffy old grandpa show in many ways.
Yeah, yeah. They're all kind of marching around and like, oh, I'm a man, Yeah,
and there's a whole scene where there's like, I think a half an hour without a song. I think the Congress scene in Act 1, it might hold the record for like the longest bit in a musical with no song.
That's too long.
And I was like, okay, when are they going to sing? When are they going to sing?
You get Lin-Manuel Miranda to just write a song and put it in there.
Exactly. For a lot of it, I was just like, why aren't they rapping? Or like, this would be so much better if they were just
the
rapping.
The founding people, the founding fathers need to rap.
Yeah. But this revival was like, I think the performances were great. I had a friend in it, shout out Sav from Young Actors Theater Camp.
Nice.
But I think the show kind of felt bound by the material to play it straight. Mm-hmm. In the sense of there's only so much you could be subversive with this kind of material where it's so kind of stuffy and sophisticated.
Do you think like maybe it would be better if they camped it up and like took the same material?
Yeah,
I
thought they could have made it gayer. I thought they could have made it a lot more irreverent. Because I think the glaring thing for me was that, 1776 is a show that was written in 1969, at a time where the reverence for the American political system and the political process and kind of overall pride in the country just meant a different thing. It was more old-fashioned mythology, like right before the Vietnam War. And those kind of contexts play differently now, where we have a much different relationship with our American government and with the American myth of the quote-unquote founding of our country. And so by playing it straight and by kind of inhabiting the bodies of these, old founding fathers without really changing so much of the subtext beyond just, hey, we're different bodies taking up these characters, they had a really interesting framing device where the actors stepped on stage at the very beginning, removed their, you know, modern shoes, and then literally stepped into the buckled shoes of the founding fathers who they're portraying.
Avant-garde.
Yeah. And basically just saying, we are these people now, rather than, I don't know, making a statement and trying to modernize it further, which I think they could have done.
Yeah, no, I mean, I feel like also they're probably worried that if they do take it any farther than that, that maybe the right or the left.
Yeah, I mean,
you're kind of trying to balance it.
It's being labeled woke 1776, but it's not really woke. It's just, you know, with
different gender casting,
with diverse performers. Mm-hmm. And there are some moments that call into question, you know, the legacies of various, the legacies of the show itself and the people who they're trying to portray, and mm-hmm. kind of the, you know, ideas about how posterity will remember us and blah, 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 blah.
Hmm. Yeah.
But overall, I had a good time. I'm not trying to I'm not trying to knock on this production. I just think that 1776 isn't really my cup of tea. I would so much rather just watch Hamilton at this point.
Yeah, you know, and the sad thing is Hamilton was not even in any of those meetings. So like, he was just busy doing something else.
Right. Like, I mean, it's the same time period as Hamilton, but mm-hmm. not until it takes place before actual Alexander Hamilton comes on the scene.
Yeah, before he was cool.
Yeah.
Or whatever. Well, maybe somebody just needs to relook at that situation and write another musical. I mean, like, I wouldn't mind another Hamilton type musical, you know, with another founding father or something.
No. I don't. Personally, I don't think we need Ben Franklin the musical or John Hancock the musical.
It'd be kind of racy if you get Ben Franklin. He was a little scandalous.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I think we have such a different relationship with that time period now. I feel like people don't really care about not honoring, but just like revering that kind of time. It was definitely an important part of history, but I think, I don't know, Hamilton kind of covered it. And I think anything that would be kind of created now would be compared to Hamilton endlessly.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people, they have a hard time with thinking of the founding fathers as like human beings. You know, they're like, oh my gosh, it's George Washington. But you know, I taught my class the other day and I was like, George Washington, do you know where he got his teeth from? His slaves. Like, you just gotta like think about like, people were human. They weren't like the most amazing, fantastic, wonderful, mythological creatures.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of, you know, political posturing and bothering about how we teach history these days. And I think we're kind of collectively unlearning the American myth that, you know, the founding fathers were these perfect scholars.
Yeah, I cannot tell a lie.
Yeah, we're so nobly
popping the cherry tree now.
Yeah, exactly. Those kind of stories that we tell for children are not necessarily the most accurate history, obviously, but they can shape the way that people view the Constitution and the country that they live in. And it becomes obviously dangerous when we have people who are, you know, holding originalist constitutional values and using the founding fathers as a scapegoat for why they should have to defend their unpopular and harmful positions today.
Yeah, totally. I agree.
And so, yes, it's important to examine that aspect of history, but I don't know. To me,
well, what would you revive instead? Yeah. I mean, like, what would you revive instead? I mean, do you think that they just revived 1776 because of the Hamilton phenomenon?
I mean, Hamilton definitely sparked a trend of, like, historical revisionist genre musicals with atypical casting. Yeah. You know, you got Six and Juliet, like, these kind of
female-empowered
retelling old historical or, you know, Shakespearean stories, but from a different perspective.
I mean, I'd rather see music. Jesus, like, that they did at A Ray of Light a few years ago, you know?
Yeah,
like,
Jesus Christ Superstar Jesus with women.
All female, yeah. Or Spamalot, you know? Like, and the Lady of the Lake could be a beautiful drag queen. I love that.
I think it's less about transplanting, you know, diverse performers into these more quote-unquote traditional roles in musicals, and just I think it would be so much more interesting to create a new historical musical, but just like actually from the perspective of, you know, an underrepresented category rather than trying to slot someone in.
Yeah. Open up at Ford's Theater. Abraham Lincoln has just died. It opens just like Evita. I don't know.
Yeah. Let's do Mary Todd Lincoln, the musical.
Ooh. She goes crazy. About grief
and schizophrenia or whatever she had.
Yeah, no, she does. She really does. And she actually goes to like a lot of like seances to try and contact her husband. She even goes to this photographer where it takes like a picture of her and she's sitting there and then like Abraham Lincoln's ghost is behind her.
Featuring the music of Lady Gaga. It'll be great.
Yeah. Did you know she was only like 5 foot tall and he was like 6'4"? What a couple dynamic, you know? Well,
I mean, all they tell you about Abraham Lincoln is that he's a tall son of a bitch.
Yeah, I stood next to his statue last week when I was in D.C.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, go see 1776 while it's at the Amundsen. It's still an amazing performance. Everybody on stage was amazing. And let's get to our interview. Today we are talking with someone who we've both worked with for a while.
And we love her. She's great.
Janine Harrington, who's a choreographer, director, actor, teacher, from all over the Bay Area.
She mentored both of us.
For sure. Well, let's get right into it.
All right, here we go.
Welcome back to the Theater World Podcast. Hello again. Our guest this week is a choreographer, actor, and teacher who has worked with theater companies all over the Bay Area, most notably Tri-School High School Theater for over 20 years, and Hillbarn Theater, where she has worked with the Youth Conservatory and us, me and Zandra, for over 10 years as well. Please welcome the fabulous Janine Harrington.
Ooh. Hi, folks.
Yeah, thanks for coming. We're so excited to have you.
Thank you for having me.
We have known you for a while. We knew you through the Hillbarn Youth Conservatory in Foster City, California, doing summer theater.
Yeah,
but you are so dedicated to making theater with and for teenagers.
Yes.
What draws you to the high school age and just that period of life for young artists?
I think for me, it kind of stems back to when I was an eighth grader and I went to go see a production at Mercy High School in San Francisco. They did Grease. And for those of you who know me, you know that even though that show gets such a bad rap, it is definitely one of my favorites.
Yeah. How many times have you done it?
I think 5 total with different companies and different groups of teens. That experience of seeing that show at Mercy High School was really pivotal in kind of forming the rest of my life. I had such a silly story, but I was set on track to go to a school in San Francisco called Presentation. And I was going to Prez because my best friend, Jenny Mullen, was going to Prez. And wherever she was going to go, I was going to go. And we didn't really give it a second thought until I saw that production of Grease at Mercy High School. And I knew immediately that this is where I needed to be. And so long story short, through a lot of tears, crying to mom and initially signing up for their summer theater program, I was able to make the transfer and make theater really become my life. And my experiences there in high school, I would say I was very, very lucky to have wonderful mentors and teachers. And I think as I got older into my adulthood, I really recognized how much I wanted to be that for the youth and for kids who feel like they've been bit by the theater bug. I think it's a really, really important outlet, even for kids that maybe don't intend to do it for the rest of their lives or make a career out of it. I think, you know, the bonding aspect and the ability to create a piece of art together from the ground up teaches you so many life skills that go way beyond, you know, the skills that you need for theater and dance. So It's just been a passion of mine, and I try to find ways to do it outside my regular 9-to-5 as often as I possibly can.
Wow. I mean, that's crazy that your whole trajectory of life, you had this pathway that brought, where you were like on some other route too. Were you going to do something else instead of theater before that?
That's a great question. So most of my background was in dance, and I definitely planned to continue to take dance classes, hopefully at the high school level and beyond. But I would say the trajectory of my life changed a lot with going to Mercy, just because it wasn't just dance now. It was more of a musical theater pathway, and that just sort of changed the direction. I always tell the high school kids at tri-school, we do a morning matinee for kids in the area. And we always talk about how, of all the audiences that you're going to perform in front of, this one is the most important.
Yeah.
And I share that story about how this literally changed my life. And there could be, you know, 3 or 4 or maybe even 10 kids out there who maybe think that they're going to be getting into high school sports or into student council or any other facet that is offered through through high school. And they might decide then and there, they might become so inspired by your performance that they decide to, you know, change their pathway. So it's definitely a wonderful experience. And I, you know, kind of like pets, I will say that I have learned probably as much, if not more so, from the students in my productions than the things that I could teach them.
Yeah, I mean, I took my students there, and I remember you know, to your show, Matilda, when you did Matilda, and I remember asking a lot of them, I was like, well, do you think you want to do that? You know, I was like, you know, a little egging them on a little bit because I love theater. And some of them were like, yeah, I think that'd be fun for next year. So I'm excited to maybe see some of my students up there on stage next
year. Awesome. Awesome.
Because, yeah, like when you're in high school theater or just in high school, even, like, I feel like you don't realize how much you're modeling behavior for people younger than mm-hmm. you. Like, yeah. I remember watching, like, one of the reasons I wanted to go to the high school I went to, San Mateo High School, was because of their theater program. Mm-hmm. And watching high school shows while I was in elementary and middle school, it looked amazing. Like, not just... I mean, I already loved acting, but just seeing people on stage older than me, mm-hmm. living their truth and living their lives, and it means a lot more than just, you know, watching a fun production of Guys and Dolls or whatever.
Right, right. I mean, I think back to that production of Grease at Mercy High School, and I asked those actors for their autographs. Mm-hmm. I went back and saw it 3 more times. I ultimately ended up becoming really good friends with 2 of the people that were in that production. I would say they kind of took me under their wing as I entered Mercy as a freshman. And yeah, it's just, you're right. The example that you set and the role model opportunity goes way beyond just the talent and the skill of the performers on stage.
Do you remember your first performance at Mercy? Like what it felt like when getting on the stage, besides like turning to the turntables and stuff like that?
Yeah. My most vivid memory, and it's so funny, you know, people say that the sense of smell is such a powerful conjurer of memories. And I would say that walking into that theater, there was a smell, right? There's mm-hmm. there's a smell in mm-hmm. most buildings, and definitely in theaters. And I would always kind of immediately be transported back of the magic of sitting in the audience and watching that production. I did a musical theater camp there between my 8th grade year and my freshman year, which ultimately set the wheels in motion for me being able to transfer and become a student. And we did like a musical theater workshop, very similar to the ones that we would do at Hill Barn. But they did a musical review, and they picked different songs and numbers from different classic musicals that sort of fit the kids that they had enrolled at the camp at the time. And so I got to do a spackling of really just very different eclectic things. I got to play Annie in Annie, which was amazing. I got to sing.
You can still do it today.
Yeah. Did they put a red wig on you?
Not for the summer camp, but funny enough, my first main stage production at Mercy was Annie, and I played Annie in that one. And we did have a wig, and it was horrible. The kids were playing, the crew kids were playing catch with the with the wig backstage with the dog, God. Sandy.
Oh, no.
And so it was just a mangled mess. Yeah,
that not, must not be my... why you're so particular with hair. You like are super particular with everyone's hair when we do shows. I remember like you trying on many wigs for one person that we were doing Anything Goes, and you're like, not that, not that, not that. And she was like, let me just do my hair. And you're like, okay.
Yeah, it might have stemmed from that bad experience from the Annie wig.
I just unlocked some trauma for you.
Yes, it totally did. Totally.
It's funny you mentioned the smell of the theater. It's like one of my earliest memories of seeing a show at Tri-School was you know how you remember things from years ago and you're not really sure if it's true, but you remember what you remember.
Yes.
I remember like the rumor of like going to see a show at Tri-School in like the early 2010s and everybody saying that it still smelled like spray tan from the time you did Aida.
Oh man, you had to bring that up.
When you mentioned Tri-School and the smell of theater, that's what I remember.
It's it's in that that particular situation doing Aida, you know, if you've kind of followed our program, we've recently received kind of a lot of criticism for attempting to do a show like Aida, A, at the high school level, but B, also in an arena where we didn't technically have the right ethnic group to producing that particular show. I think, you know, back then, and you know, you learn better and then you do better. But hey, I think
my first show with you was Aida at Hillmark Theater.
Yeah.
And I had a great time.
Yeah. And I think you know, that it just makes you aware of how things are perceived by others. From our perspective, it was a beautiful story to tell.
It
requires, as you remember, really strong vocalists, and we had really strong vocalists at the time. And so, you know, we made that choice. And at the time, the show was phenomenal. And I think basically everybody involved had a really positive experience. But looking back, people have, you know, kind of stepped forward and said, you know, probably not the best choice for, you know, a school with predominantly white students, although I would argue a little bit about that. But I get it. I see where we're headed, and maybe in a better direction.
Hey, I did Once on This Island in high school. There's all things. It's true. Like, hey, we had a great time, but it's like, I don't know if we'd do it that way again.
Right, right.
Sorry. How has that changed, like, your way of, like, choosing a show now then?
I think it just makes us more aware and careful. This is definitely a hard time for, I would say, junior high and high school theater, only because of that component of having to be very, very careful, both with, you know, political correctness and also, you know, with younger casts, you have to be careful of, some of the subject matter that happens in a lot of the shows that we would like to do. Like, you know, for example, I know many schools would love the opportunity to do Rent. Mm-hmm. And yet there are, you know, there are elements to that show that are not necessarily PG or PG-13. So
harder for teenagers to understand the lived experience.
Right.
I mean, that was of the time, you know, like
exactly.
It's history to them now.
Exactly. So I think choosing shows with that component and now the added component of, you know, just wanting to be open and aware and making sure that you are not offending people in a way that you never intended to, but people coming forward and kind of sharing their experiences and their perceptions now, mm-hmm. it does make things a little bit different. I'll just bring up one show in particular that I think people think is so innocent because it's so old and it's considered a classic. And that would be the Rodgers and Hammerstein, Oklahoma. We've all been involved mm-hmm. in that production and never really given it a second thought. And now people are kind of coming forward and saying, really? You know, one of the main characters who has a mental illness is basically being told he's in a joking
into
way
kill himself.
Into killing himself. Yeah. Right. And, you know, generations of people laughed at that without mm-hmm. really mm-hmm. thinking about, wow, that's really, really insensitive and just basically wrong.
Well, they had alcohol and cigarettes to mask all that in the 50s.
Janine, did you see the new revival of Oklahoma that kind of
strips
away and gives new context to all these things?
I didn't.
I think I saw it and I loved it. And I think it was the best version of Oklahoma that I've seen because, I mean, I think we're in the era of the life cycle of musical theater where it's necessary to take these classic shows that we love so much, like Oklahoma, like Grease, and mm-hmm. re-examine what does it actually mean in a modern context to be performing this?
Yeah.
Because Oklahoma, on its surface, is very quaint. It's very old-timey. It's all, you know, all about old-style gender relations, and mm-hmm. it's easy to kind of look past a lot of the, I don't know, more old-fashioned, misogynistic, et cetera, elements of it. Mm-hmm. And I think there's more incumbency on theater makers these days to, I mean, not just, you know, have a message, woo woo, blah, 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 but to interrogate the text and say, yeah, we still want to do Oh, What a Beautiful Morning and all these great musical numbers that people love, but what does it mean in the context of teenagers in 2023 telling this story without just doing it with a, you know, a smile and a wink?
Right. Well, I think then it kind of begs the question of that fine line between, you know, if something is dated or it has elements that could be perceived as offensive in any way to a modern audience, do we change the text or do we do it the way it was written? Because I tend to be a bit of a purist. We do it the way it was written and we have a lot of education and talk around why in 1954 were they presenting this side of society. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at what point does a piece of theater lose its value because the message or elements in the context of the story are dated and could be perceived as, you know, offensive. So it's hard. It's like, do you go ahead and do it the way it was written? Because as you mentioned, you know, Oh, What a Beautiful Morning. Like there's all these incredibly beautiful pieces of music and phenomenal opportunities for dancers and choreographers. So do we leave it as it is? And we talk to these kids and have a really heart-to-heart open dialogue about elements of the show that no longer hold true and what that means to be a performer on the stage and presenting these pieces. I don't know. It's a fine line.
You need like kind of like a thing in the program too, or some kind of talk before the show even begins, like to just be like, here's a disclaimer. This was written in the 50s and it was, you know, one of the first musicals, like official musicals that had like a plot that and music that moved the plot along. You know, and this is an important piece of history because I don't think we can erase history because like that's just like something that's there, you know, like, so it is a fine line, you know, what you've said.
Yeah. We had a student journalist at Sarah write for the school newspaper when we did Oklahoma a few years ago. And that was his point exactly. He was like, why are we in 2016 putting on a show where women are being kind of auctioned off at the auction block? Like, and I had never, to me, it was just a story. It didn't mean that we as a theater company or a high school were making a statement. Mm-hmm. It just meant we were doing this piece of theater. So you definitely have to be more careful. High schoolers today are really savvy in seeing things in the broader picture and what mm-hmm. that message might mean to audience members. So it's an interesting time to be in theater for sure.
Well, let's talk about this because, I mean, it's so funny that you mentioned so early. One of our notes that we wrote down was ask Janine about Grease. Because because we know that you have such a connection to that show and that, I mean, you've done it 5 times, probably more. And and I just know how excited you get when you're thinking about the Pink Ladies and Tell Me More, and just like mm-hmm. kind of every bit of that show. And I think that is another one of those shows that that when done so popularly, so commonly at a high school level, deserves a lot of reexamination of like, what is actually happening here? Because I mean, to me, Grease is a fun show out of context. I think the songs are so, so fun when you don't really involve yourself in what the story is going on around them.
Right. And wasn't it originally written as a parody of the 50s? Like they were like, this was horrible, LOL. And now everyone's taking it as fact or something like that.
Well, it's, see that, so yeah, that's definitely a really good question. So the two writers of that show actually created that show based on caricatures of people that they grew up with. So there is a lot of truth to the stereotypes of these two gang members and the idea of the bad girls and the bad boys mm-hmm. versus, you know, when in an outsider's perspective, we would say kind of the Greases versus the Socs kind of thing.
Right.
So it's hard because in my opinion, theater should do one of two things. It should either take you away and transport you to either another time or another realm or another world and let you get swept up in the entertainment. Mm-hmm. Or it should make you really feel and learn something. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I would say that Grease qualifies as the latter.
Yeah, yeah.
I have always loved it because of its ability to transport me away into the world of the 50s, which I don't know why or where I got this obsession for that particular time period. But for me, that's really what it's all about. And I think also, the fun of being able to put on a character that's so kind of rough and tough and popular.
Yeah, it's stylized in a really fun way.
Yeah. And I think a lot of kids that do theater like to put on that particular persona of being the cool kids and the ones that everybody
looks up. Well, because theater kids aren't cool usually.
What?
Well, unless you go to San Mateo High School, those were the cool kids.
Unless you're me.
So, you know, it's hard because I now see where the problem kind of lies with that. Well, I mean, there are many problems. Yeah. Let me just quantify that they're definitely
itemize them.
Exactly. So, but when I say I now see, I think there are things that have been sort of brought to my attention, or I've even examined and seen now things that seem so innocent and so funny and so cheeky that now you're like, ooh. Yeah. So there was a show that was talking about the movie Grease, which is super iconic with John Travolta
of
and
course.
Now rest her soul, Olivia mm-hmm. Newton-John. But the people that were putting together this program were talking about how this production should never be put on again until it's fixed. And by fixed, I mean lyrics that we don't even think about. So off the bat in Summer Nights, Kanicki says to Danny, did she put up a fight?
Right.
Yeah.
Whoa, we've been singing that cheeky and laughing and you know, kind of making fun of it. And I don't think a lot of us really examined what it is exactly that Kanicki is saying. So, you know, now there's this whole, you know, group of people that are like, Danny Zuko is basically a misogynistic date rapist. And I'm like,
yes. Yes,
oh my God. Like, I mean, I never even considered it from that perspective, because again, it's putting on a character. Being campy. And now, you know, you really do have to be careful. And I see it
in the drive-in scene a lot. You're like,
Yeah. So, you know, sadly, I don't think that production has its place on stage anymore, especially at a high school level, unless you really take the opportunity, like you said, of re-examining it the way Oklahoma has been re-examined and maybe fixing some of those components.
Because it's one of those shows where it's so well suited for high schools in terms of high schoolers playing high schoolers. There's tons of dance numbers. There's tons of characters who sing. It's perfect for that kind of form. But yeah, like it gets into a slippery slope of is it worth not erasing a classic work of theater, but kind of watering it down to preserve what we like about it. Like, yes, there's unwanted pregnancy, and yes, there's mentions of date rape, but there's also ram-a-lam-a-lam-a-lam-a-ding-a-ding-ding-dong.
Right, and we go together.
Yeah, are there shows, I think, where you can allow yourself to separate the context of the show and the morals of the show from just 2 hours of enjoyment? Because I can tell that, you know, at least for you, it just the show itself brings so much enjoyment from the singing and the dancing and the costumes and the accents.
It could be a little more presented like Rocky Horror, you know, where it's more you're cued to do extra something, like where cheek. He says something, you know, like when they say something, you put up like a cue card where they go cringe or something. You know, like throw something at the stage and make it more interactive or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know, but it's definitely one of the many that have been done thousands of times on a high school stage that now really has to be, you know, re-examined. And then, you know, like you said, do we throw something out because it presents things in a way that maybe we don't look at things through that lens anymore? Mm-hmm. You know, where is that fine line? And, you know, like I said, certainly the teenage pregnancy is always something that comes up as a concern. The other big issue with that show is many people perceive it as the message at the end is that girls should change themselves to be likable to a boy, to which I would argue Danny changes himself too. He also tries on, you know, a different persona to fit in with more what he thinks would align with what Sandy likes. But that part is downplayed because of the campiness of that big reveal of Sandy at the end when she turns into the bad girl. So it's hard. There's a lot of things about that show that really are problematic for a high school level, for sure.
In the junior version, I think Rizzo finds out that Kaneki kissed somebody else. So it's like, you know, there's a junior version of this show and you're just like, oh my gosh, okay. And then there's like Dragon Wagon and all these new lyrics that you're added. And it's just like, huh.
Yeah, it's a conversation now of, you know, re-examining, like, because there are so many classic shows that I don't know, I won't say weren't problematic for so long, but weren't examined properly for so long. Where it's like, what do we do with these classic shows that we love so much? You know, they're still reviving, I don't know, My Fair Lady and The King and I or whatever, like these kind of old shows that have problematic elements, but they're so much outweighed by the nostalgia people feel for the structural elements,
changed My Fair Lady at the end, you know, like leaves the theater. She walks, steps right out and he says, give me my slippers. And she's like, bye.
I mean, it just begs a really interesting question of like, what is the duty of theater gatekeepers and theater directors to preserve classic works of theater without, you know, I don't know, bastardizing or completely changing things and bringing a modern context to a modern sensibility without just having, you know, I don't know, quote unquote, PC grease, where where like it's all just about, you know, the kiss or
driving a car,
taking away the quote unquote fun, but bizarre and icky elements of it. Then what do you have left?
Right. Right. And how much can you change it and still keep the integrity of the pieces that work, you know, outside of those kind of, as you said, icky elements. Yeah. So it's hard. It's definitely a conversation that a lot of junior high and high school teachers are having online and in different forums. Like, how do we pick a show? Like, what's left out there that's not going to offend people, that's not going to require a demographic that we maybe don't have at our high mm-hmm. school level? And how can we go about, you know, putting on quality productions that are competitive? And when I say competitive, I mean, you know, eighth graders, when they're picking a high school, they have a choice. There are many different right. Mm-hmm. options for them here in San Mateo. And, you know, for us, with the added element of the Catholicism and, you know, sort of some of the religious mm-hmm. aspects that make people uncomfortable, you know, we lose out on a lot of shows that are being done at some of the public high schools.
Yeah, like Legally Blonde, I'm sure, right?
Legally Blonde or Mamma Mia mm-hmm. or Rent or, you know, many of these other more modern shows. And so, you know, we've kind of come back to the drawing table time and time again saying, here's the problem. The classics are problematic because of the lack of PC that happens in many of them. And the modern shows are very crass. And in a high school level, there's only so far you can go. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you throw into it the element of, well, technically, when you get the rights for a show, you're not supposed to really touch yeah. it or change it yeah. or, you know, change the lines around a little bit or change a word here and there so it's not so offensive. So where do we go from here?
You call Tegan and McKenna Reynolds and they have exactly. them write you a musical.
Exactly. And that's exactly what I was going to bring up. You know, the Reynolds girls did an incredible job creating a piece that is available and can be done anywhere with pretty much any age group of kids, junior high through high school. There's no romance involved, so there's no worry about, you know, any of the sexuality.
Yeah. Or forced kissing. Oh, no.
Exactly. These things that become problematic to the younger kids that are doing theater. And, you know, they created a piece from the ground up that was mm-hmm. premiered this past spring at Burrell. And we need more of that. We mm-hmm. need more shows that, like you said, you know, the Grease component where there's so many leads, there's a lot of opportunity for many, many kids to shine, to do that in a way that has a really positive message that kids can relate to mm-hmm. and gives many kids an opportunity to shine. So we need more of that, please. So any of you out there that are talented in writing or composing, please create stuff for junior high and high school theater kids that they would be on fire to get up and present and do.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's ultimately a step in the right direction that, you know, theater makers are just becoming more intentional about how they select their shows. And yes, there is more of an expectation these days to have a point of view or a message or, you know, something to say with your choice and direction. And that's a good thing. Like, sure, there are some things that always are going to work. Like, high schoolers are going to keep doing Oklahoma. But it's important as directors to examine the context of what it means to be putting on a show today. And that doesn't mean erasing a whole lot of musical theater, but it means just considering it and understanding the context.
Right, right.
Well, let's move on and talk about your time in a historic piece of San Francisco Ooh, theater. Yes. You spent a few years part in Beach Blanket Babylon.
Oh, there you I have did. Your little, is that your robe from
your, that's
from
my your, jacket.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, it closed like 2-3 years ago, I believe, right before the pandemic. They apparently they knew what was happening or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you give us a little history of Beach Blanket Babylon? Because I mean, it's an institutional piece of San Francisco theater, cabaret theater, et cetera. And I'm really bummed I never got to see it. I wish I could have gone as a kid,
I was three times,
you know, my parents said, you know, you're too young, and, you know, it's kind of risque adult. And then by the time I was, you know, quote unquote, old enough, I was out of town and was gone.
At school, so Beach Blanket Babylon was created by an incredibly creative man named Steve Silver. And it has a long history of, you know, it kind of started out on a street corner and then moved to another location and then ultimately ended up at Club Fugazi in San Francisco, where it's been marketed as the longest running musical revue in history. I saw it when I was 5 years old. My parents took me to a Sunday matinee where they cleaned it up just a little bit.
Right.
And I have two very distinct memories from that production. One, I know that I loved it. Two, I remembered the character Snow White. And I remembered the John Travolta character who did like a Stayin' Alive kind of spiel. So basically, the storyline of Beach Blanket Babylon didn't change much over all these years. Most of the time, the storyline was based on Snow White going around the world to find her prince. There was a chunk of time there in the late 80s where instead of Snow White, they used the Dorothy Gale character from Wizard of Oz, but then ultimately went back to Snow White. And so what changes constantly are the sort of pop culture elements to the show. So basically anything that was front page news or things that made people stir would find their way into the storyline of Beach Blanket Babylon. And very, very crass, very silly, very campy, super famous for its incredibly ginormous and heavy hats. When I was in it, some of the sort of silly political charged things or pop culture things were, if you remember the Lorena Bobbitt instance that happened back in the 90s. I won't talk too much about that, but that was a hilarious bit in Beach Blanket when I was doing it. The Tonya Harding situation with the ice skaters and the baseball bats. Yes. I mean, anything that could stir people up, whether it was political or pop culture, made its way into the storyline. So I kind of went on a whim. They would do these huge open calls at Club Fugazi on Saturdays. And I don't even remember what prompted me to go other than I just wanted to try it out. I was brand new into the college scene. And wanted to just see what it would be like to audition for something real. The line went around the block and the people auditioning were as eclectic as you could possibly imagine, because like I said, the show encompassed so many different caricatures and silly real life people of the time. And I remember that some people would get up there and get one sentence into their song and they'd be like, thank you. And I was like, this is like so harsh. This is like really scary, you know? So I was like, oh, I hope I can at least sing two sentences of my song. So I did, and they stopped me pretty quickly. And I thought, okay, that's it. I'm done. And they said, thank you. Can you do that song like Snow White? And of course, at that point, I hadn't seen the show since I was five. I didn't know much about it, but I knew that Snow White talked with a really high-pitched voice. And so I just went right into that voice and started singing like that. And they let me do a few more sentences, and then they said, thank you. I thought I was done. And as I walked down off the stage, one of the people at the at the audition panel, said, we'd like you to come back at 3. Ooh. And I was like, oh my God, oh my God. This was before cell phones. Yeah. So don't I had to run down the street in North Beach and find a payphone and call my parents and be like, don't pick me up. I'm staying longer. And I was like, I couldn't believe it. So yeah, it turned out that at that particular open call, they were looking for a new understudy for Snow White. And the setup of Beach Blank is a little bit different than like national tours or Broadway shows, where understudies are typically in the ensemble. And then obviously if a lead character is sick, that understudy would, you know, come up from the ensemble and do the lead role. That's not the way that they did it at Beach Blanket. You were either a principal performer or you were an understudy. And so
as kind of like a cover.
Yeah, exactly. Or a swing kind of. Right.
Would you be on property or would you be at home?
Great question. So like I said, this was before cell phones, and you, in your contract, you were required to be in San Francisco during the hour and a half leading up to the show and throughout the show hours. And so basically we had pagers because that was the new technology.
Of course.
I would call in to John backstage, love that man. And he would say, you're good, Janine, or I need you to come in. I recall one time where I got a call about a half hour into the show time. So it was a 2-show night. They would sometimes do a 7:30 and a 10 p.m. show. And I got a call around 8 o'clock. Immediately, they paged me. I immediately called in and I said, do you need me to come and do the 10 o'clock show? And he said, no, I need you to get here and finish this one. Okay. And I was like, oh my God, oh my God. Like, so my dad piled me into the car. I'm putting my makeup on in the back seat. I'm slicking my hair back. Knowing that as soon as I got there, I was going to have to spray my hair blonde, because Snow White at that time wore a Snow White wig, but underneath had to be prepared to turn into Madonna.
Of course.
So, and my hair wasn't bleached. She flies, right? Yes. Madonna would fly over the audience, like a prayer. So fun. I had to get there and finish the production that the primary Snow White was doing. And what had happened was she had been going through the beginning parts of the show. She had had some back issues leading into this, and she just determined that she was in too much pain to continue. And so that me finishing that show was the start of about a 5-month run of where I became the primary Snow White until they could find a permanent solution. The permanent solution basically meant that Linda was coming back, mm-hmm. but she had to be out on disability for a short time. And I went from doing one guaranteed show a month to 8 shows a week.
Yikes.
Wow.
That's a lot of shows.
It's a lot of shows.
So you basically had to mummify yourself in the mornings and just like sleep all day.
Yes and no. At the time I was a first grade aide at Holy Name in San Francisco. So I would do that in the morning and then go home and rest. But ultimately, the need for vocal rest, during the day really was my downfall. Teaching with little kids and mm-hmm. having to use my voice during the day and then mm-hmm. having to put on that high pitched, Snow White voice ultimately was what led to me, having to make the decision to leave the show. As I started to develop nodes on my vocal cords, really heartbreaking, really, really hard to leave the show. It was a magical experience for me from every aspect. I loved the people that I was working with. I loved the character. I loved the opportunity. But ultimately from a voice health perspective, that's what kind of drew me to ultimately leave the show.
Going back to where they called you, mm-hmm. did they hold the show or were they just going through the show until she was like, relieve me?
Yep. She just had to keep going.
Wow. It was different now. I'm sure, like, you know, today you see actors taking care of themselves a little bit more, you know, now no longer like pushing it, you know, calling in sick when they just start not feeling it, you know? Yeah. And I noticed at my school too, you know, my students are also doing that as well, you know, taking more time for themselves and making sure that they feel okay and well.
Yeah, I think if there was only, if I could say only one positive thing that came out of COVID, because believe me, I do not have positive things to say about COVID, but I will say that it did force us to take a stronger look at our own well-being and, you know, the need to take care of ourselves. I think anybody that is in the teaching realm, you know, it was just an unspoken rule. You go to school sick. And unless you're, you know, really sick, like fever or vomiting, God forbid, you know, you take a Tylenol and you suck it up because A, subs are few and far between. And B, it's just so much work to put together sub plans. And you by the time you think that through, you're like, I'm just going to take an Advil and go to work. And I think COVID really curbed that, you know, that if you have even a sniffle or you're feeling run down, you know, take the time till you are well and can be 100% for the kid. So that definitely is a positive thing that came out of that horrible, horrible experience.
And hopefully we won't change that, you know, and just go back to grind and until you are basically.
Right.
Well, I mean, that's amazing that you got to be, you know, part of such a historic legacy and whatnot. Let's move on to our theater world lightning round. Ask some rapid fire questions. Janine, who is your favorite Broadway diva?
I'd have to say Kristen Chenoweth.
Of course. I mean,
I thought you were going to say Adam Pascal. He's kind of a Broadway diva.
Well, if I were picking a male, I would say Adam Pascal. I love Kristen Chenoweth.
Yeah, she's great. I mean, she's so supportive of Ariana Grande right now, being in Wicked.
Yeah, she's and she's a dog person, and I know that she's not everybody's taste, but I just love that voice.
You guys probably be really good friends.
I would love that.
Do you watch Schmigadoon?
I have not started, but my sister began it this week and texted me a couple of times and said, you are going to love it. You've got to get started.
She's fabulous on that show. She's awesome. Her character is incredibly wicked.
Yay! Yeah. Even better.
She's kind of like the temperance ladies, you know, like with the axes.
Not capital W wicked, lowercase W wicked.
Right, right. Yeah. Love it, love it.
All right, and what is your dream role? Or maybe you've already had it.
That is a great question. Yes. Way too old for that. I still really would love to play Glinda. Kristen Chenoweth's role. I also would love to be Fontaine in Les Mis, and those are two different types of characters. But unfortunately, I think the timing has passed for both of those.
Never say never, Janine. Never say never.
Well, it's a few years behind me now.
Okay, what is your least favorite high school musical? Like the when you see a high school do this, you're like, oh, really?
You're like, no.
Pirates of Penzance.
Oh, come on. Boo.
The Pirate King.
I love the Pirates of Penzance. It's one of my favorite shows.
I'm sorry.
I did the Pirates of Penzance.
It's all the jumping, probably.
As a middle school summer production.
Oh, how cute.
So we had to learn it in 4 weeks.
And at Hilbert?
No, it was at ETC, at Educational Theater Company. I, of course, was Frederick. The romantic lead.
I love it.
But I fell in love with that show. Like, I think, for me, one of my favorite comedic devices is just, like, people mishearing things. And, like, there's so many just, like, people mishearing things and misspeaking and not seeing things on stage. It's so funny. There's an opera company in LA that's doing a production of Pirates of Penzance later this year that I'm so excited to see because I've never seen it on stage. But I mean, I agree that it's not really a show that is meant to be done with high schoolers.
Well, you've made me want to like re-examine it now. Yeah. Your passion has made me want to re-examine it.
It genuinely makes me laugh the whole time. It's so funny.
Yeah, you could just take out the kidnapping of ladies.
See, but it's so cringe.
Like, I mean, there's like three whole songs in
it's
a row
quaint about how, kidnapping
about like the nurse and how ugly she is. Like, there's
right. See, I'm Fine. That's my point. I just don't know.
Ding ding ding, your meter.
and you've got the stupid police officers. It's great. I am a Pirates of Penzance defender.
I'll stand up for that. Also the model of the modern Major General.
Yes, I know binomial theorem and can quote the fight's historical from Marathon to Waterloo and order categorical.
Oh, brother, he really knows that show.
Yeah.
All right. What song or moment or show that always makes you cry?
Oh, wow. Okay. There's a couple. I would say now, having done Matilda this past spring, there are moments in the song Quiet.
That's what I was thinking.
That Matilda sings that are that really stir my emotions. And when I grow up, just that idea of how when you're little, you just think the world is going to be your oyster. Right. And then you get to be a grown up and you're like, uh-oh, somebody lied.
What'd you think of really the Matilda, the new movie?
I really enjoyed it.
I thought it was wonderful.
I think they did a great job. I had never seen Matilda at all, and I kind of dedicated Christmas vacation this year to educating myself because we were going to be doing it, and obviously I needed to see it.
Like a few weeks.
So I saw two live productions, and I saw the movie as kind of background and homework. And there are elements about the stage production that I like better, but I think they did, in general, a really good job with the movie. I think there were many magical moments and obviously some incredible performances. I think they did a pretty epic job at the very end.
I was like, whoa, they really brought really those chokies job. Out.
They sure did.
And finally, Janine, no pressure, but what is the single greatest experience you've ever had at the theater? This could be on stage, off stage, backstage. Just the first thing comes to your mind as the greatest experience you've ever had.
So this is a really a magical moment. I did West Side Story at Broadway by the Bay quite a few years back. Mm-hmm. And I was a shark girl, which probably would never happen again because I am not Puerto Rican. And really, that's one of those other things that's kind of up for discussion about race. Anyway, there is a dream ballet sequence where this magical world where the jets and the sharks kind of come together as one. And instead of being at war with one another, they're happy and playing. And I always envision this to be taking place in heaven. I don't know why, but that's the image that it conjures. So the very first dress rehearsal, we're coming onto stage, and there was a really sweet moment with three shark girls and three jet boys where we got to do this really beautiful ballet with lifts. And we began by coming towards each other from opposite sides of the stage. And as I walked towards my partner with these magical lights, and I'm thinking I'm in heaven, I see that my jet partner is wearing my dad's shirt. Literally my dad's shirt.
Whoa.
And my dad had just passed away about 3 or 4 months beforehand. And the hairs on the back of my neck and the goosebumps, I really felt for a magical moment that I was partner dancing with my dad, and that my dad was lifting me.
That's so
really, like, it's such a small thing, but and then of course, as soon as the number was over, I came off stage and just sobbed hysterically because I just could not. I was like, where did you get that shirt? And it, somehow we figured out, I don't know if my mom had given them to Goodwill or somehow in the purchasing, it was a pretty distinct.
Things were happening for a reason.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So that was definitely my most magical moment on stage.
Wow, that's special. I mean, theater can really bring that out of people.
Was that at Broadway by the Bay with Burl Davis as the choreographer? Amazing.
Correct.
The Burl Davis.
Yes. The Burl Davis learned many wonderful, wonderful things from that man.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Janine, for coming on our podcast. It was wonderful to chat with you about theater.
Thank you so much for having me. This was awesome and so good to see you guys. I wish I could see you more.
Yes. Do you have anything you'd like to promote? I mean, I know that Matilda already passed, but what would you like to promote?
I do. We just found out last week that Matilda has been nominated for Outstanding Musical in the Rita Moreno.
Oh, yes. Congratulations.
And awesome. Our lead actress, Gabby Jison, who played Matilda, is also nominated in the leading actress category.
She is so talented, I have to say. I was just like watching her and I was like, oh my gosh, she's very smart on stage. Like she sure gets it.
And you know what's even better? She's like the sweetest, kindest, most respectful, soft-spoken person.
She's going to make it. She's definitely going to make it wherever she goes.
I think so too. So if anybody is out there and you live in the Bay Area, on May 8th at the San Jose Performing Arts building, we are doing snippets with several other incredibly talented high schools that will be doing little 7-minute vignettes from their musicals. And then we find out that night if we've actually won. But truthfully, as cheesy as this sound, just to be nominated is it's such an honor. So we're really excited about that. And that's going to be on May 8th.
All right. Well, that is all for this week's episode of the Theater World Podcast. Follow us on social media at theaterworld_presents. And we'll see you next time.
Bye, everyone.
See you later.
Bye.
Later, Tavis.